Distributing the Future Broadcast, August 21, 2006, open source at Microsoft.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. This week, we present portions of two conversations from the O'Reilly Radar Executive Briefing. Tim O'Reilly talks to Brian Behlendorf about lessons from Apache and CollabNet. Denise Cooper then puts Microsoft's Bill Hilf in the hot seat to talk about open source at the software giant. Before I got married, friends told me to take a good look at Kim's family and friends because I'd be making a commitment to them as well. The same is true to a lesser extent about where you work. What you work on might be interesting, but you also have to look at your relationships at work and the professional relationships your company and coworkers have because that's the network that you're joining. At O'Reilly, of course, that's half the fun. My coworkers know the coolest people, and for the most part, they're pretty happy to introduce me when I ask. You can feel it at the conferences, and you can read it on the blogs that the Radar folks write. Radar is more of how some people at O'Reilly keep their eye on where they think technology is heading. And at OSCON, there was a one-day executive briefing that featured some of the companies and people who can best articulate what's on our radar. We'll spend a few shows with excerpts from this event. Today we've got two of them. First, Tim talks with CollabNet's Brian Behlendorf about software as a service.
I had always wanted to be in the software as a service space from the beginning of CollabNet for a number of reasons. One is I was kind of inspired by that first wave of companies, even though they all, or a lot of them, you know, failed spectacularly, like Critical Path. It wasn't because the approach was bad. The approach actually made a lot of sense. And that was to run these things as services. And I liked it because it allowed you to actually launch with somewhat less mature applications and follow up with the premise that you're going to be updating it quickly. You'll be fixing the bugs as there's noticed. As a bug is noticed, you can see it in front of you rather than try to debug it over the phone with somebody, right? So we bought into that early.
So earlier in my introduction, I quoted Deborah Shropathy from Microsoft, who basically said the scale advantages that would accrue to the big players would eventually lead to a world in which, quote, being a developer on someone's platform means being hosted on their infrastructure. Do you have any take on that?
Well, I think it makes sense the comment would come from someone from Microsoft because it's the same argument for why the operating system economics favor there being only one OS vendor or a handful of them. And that after that war was won, why would anybody need an open source operating system? I think there are some things, some costs that grow faster than the number of users, the number of CPU hours, et cetera. Social networking software, for example, where you're talking about N squared connections between people, right? There are lots of algorithms to try to reduce that to less than O of N, but some problems are just hard, right? And certainly, we like to think of the metaphor being of the power grid, right? The utility grid, which we should just be able to treat it like electrons flowing over a wire. The reality is that these applications are much more complicated, much less fungible than electrons. And I think there will be these kind of meta ASPs out there. You know, that's clearly where Microsoft's headed. I mean, and Google mentioned it in their S-1 when they filed that being this idea of kind of a meta ASP made sense. I think that that's definitely a deployment platform people will choose, but I don't know if that's necessarily the one where if you're a startup company or you want to launch some new initiative, you'll naturally gravitate to that rather than run your own infrastructure. The costs of running your own infrastructure have come down, and often to do something really innovative, it's not clear whether any standard API would give you the flexibility to do that. Joe Krause talks a lot about how JotSpot didn't need to take on, you know, millions of dollars in investment before they could launch. 37 Signals is another example of this, right? Companies that were able to launch with something simple, something small, and grow it gradually, grow it with the revenue, et cetera. And I think in both those cases, running the servers, having that glimpse down the stack, right, to be able to say, oh, there's a low-level performance problem in CollabNet's case, in the NFS driver for Linux, you know, diving in and fixing that, you know, is going to help us, you know, the rest of the way up the stack.
So, coming back to differences between your experience with Apache and your experiences with CollabNet, you know, you're uniquely positioned to talk about the differences between the world of open source as it's traditionally practiced and the world of software as a service.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, And I think there are more similarities than it might appear at first. I mean, the refrain that we've heard about, well, we couldn't release our infrastructural software, you know, we've heard a couple times today, is a very, you know, something that, you know, we fell into as well, right? And I think it's not unlike a lot of software companies that said, we've built our own software, we couldn't open source this, where at a certain point you mistake the things you had to do.
Are you listening, Chris?
With core. No, I, you know, and in some cases, if Google's goal is to be the meta ASP, their goal is not to create, enable a lot of other meta ASPs, right? And in Microsoft's case, their goal isn't to create a lot of other operating system companies, right?
Right.
If a company's goal is to be the platform, you know, the provider, the kind of benevolent dictator, they're not going to open source that piece that enables it. If their role, and I think Red Hat actually falls here, is to instead be an enabler of people, of what they want to do on top of a common stack, a lot of the open source companies are like this, really, then they might hold back, you know, training materials as defensible IP, right? But the underlying enabling technology will make sense, well, to open source. One place where we, I mean, we straddle this too. Some of the bits we've kept to ourselves, no doubt, and we do take heat often from the open source community for the fact that our platform isn't all open source. But we did make the call early on that there was one piece that we were going to really get behind and put out there, which was Subversion. And part of that was because, you know, we knew not all the smartest people work for us. We knew we wanted to create something that was kind of a CVS 2.0, and the economics didn't work to make it a you know, to do it, you know, proprietarily or whatever. But it was also because we knew that as a managed service provider, as a hosting provider, if we were going to tell people to store the history of their intellectual property with us, there was a higher guarantee we needed to give them than simply, well, you could always export your data. A version control repository like Subversion or like ClearCase or like other tools, the data format of that is a very opaque thing if you're not on the development team. You could talk about open interfaces, but that's really not enough to allow people that sense of an insurance policy. I wanted to be able to go to a potential customer and say, buy into us, allow us to host your development, and if things don't work out for us, we're not going to leave you in the lurch. Because you could run your own Subversion repository, right? By giving away the code and by encouraging the development of a public community, we were able to say, not just as the technology public, not just, you know, but that your data as a potential customer is something that you have, you know, in your hands. We're not trying to take that away from you. And a lot of customers responded very positively to that message of no lock-in.
So this actually kind of brings up an interesting question with regard to a potentially broader role for Subversion in the Web 2.0 ecology. When we talk about open data, is one aspect of that, sort of version control, you know, literally where we have the ability to, you know, revert, for example, to a previous version of data or extract. You know, there's a lot of tools that you get that software developers are used to for version control systems that aren't really provided to people who are putting their data up online.
Right. I mean, the Wikipedia, other big wikis, allow you to look back at the history of the evolution of data, which in some cases is as important as the data itself. Right.
Yeah.
When you're reading a controversial page in Wikipedia, it's nice to know the back and forth that happened. I do think that the best model for open data is less something like a public API and more something like Usenet. Right,
mm-hmm.
Where the data doesn't just sit at one place, but is flooded to multiple places. Another example would be FreeDB, which mm-hmm. arose after CDDB. You guys probably know that story as well. And FreeDB, unfortunately, had its lead developers recently kind of get in a tiff and shut it down, and it might be getting picked up
somewhere else. Is that something about the Berkeley community? They seem to always...
No, well... We've had this discussion before. The Berkeley Unices share more code between them, I think, than the Linux distributions do. That's another
even
story.
But the appearances are otherwise.
Right. I think we're going to have to figure out what the word open means in relation to data. You know, in the same way that we came about to a definition of open source that was about the right to modify and redistribute modified works. Can I modify Wikipedia articles and redistribute them? You know, and Creative Commons is kind of an answer there. But it doesn't feel like open data to me until I can do that manipulation redistribution,
really,
and not have to depend upon one company for my application.
What are the core differences in what you learned from the Apache project versus what you've learned from CollabNet?
A lot of it hasn't been surprises. It's been reinforcements along the lines of the tools matter, but they're not everything, right? Having community managers, you know, involved in helping get people to share their code, to make their development process accessible to people beyond their own immediate teams. There's a need for that even more crying inside of corporations than on most of the open source projects that we know about, right? Mm-hmm. The other is that, you know, people do want to treat the provision of this software like a utility. And that is the polar opposite to what people's expectations are now around open source software, right? They know that they'll have to take some responsibility for what they do or how they use the software when they download Apache or they download MySQL, right? But they're very unforgiving when there's a service provider who today is 10% slower than they were yesterday, right? Mm-hmm. There's an assumption that it should just be like electricity. And that is a high standard to live up to.
Brian Bellendorf and Tim O'Reilly on Apache CollabNet and Software as a Service. Tim invited Intel and OSI's Denise Cooper up to interview Bill Helf, General Manager for Platform Strategy at Microsoft. It can't be easy standing up for Microsoft and explaining their open source strategy at a conference that attracts hardcore open source developers. Helf says that progress is being made and that
we're learning from open source. And so to learn from open source, we have to participate. So as we go through participating in conferences, working in projects, doing things like shared source, doing blogs like Port 25, it's part of our process of understanding how do we both compete and how do we find opportunity with open source. Over the past, I would say, 3-4 years, we've gone from looking at Linux and open source, just quite frankly, as something that we were fearful of. And so we had a variety of what I would call blunt instruments of how we reacted to open source and Linux. A lot of
Is
that.
Is it fair to call Ballmer that?
Huh?
Is it fair to call Ballmer that?
You misinterpreted.
Sorry.
And so a lot of that, what people saw from the outside, a lot of that was getting Microsoft on the same page internally. So we can be smarter about, hey, when we need to compete, let's understand why and how, what the ripple effect might be on where we want to actually do something cooperatively. And before, that was in different parts of the house, so to speak. So that's been the past 2.5 years.
I see. Is it, and how many people are there working towards that goal?
So all this falls under my team, and I have about 20 or 30 people in Redmond who work for me. Then I have about 100 people around the world in different parts, because part of this is making sure we don't get too wrapped up in the ivory towers of Redmond and not mm-hmm. see we are very centralized in that way, and don't see activities and participate in activities that might be just as important in Spain or Kazakhstan or the Philippines as it is in the U.S.
Sure. And how many employees does Microsoft have now?
Oh, what do we have now? 60,000?
So it's still a pretty small effort inside then.
It is, but the goal is not to be a big centralized organization full of thousands of people. I spend probably 75% of my time with our product groups, with the leadership teams of our product groups, helping them understand how you can leverage open source, how to do it correctly. The company's getting a lot smarter. So as you know, in your role, you do something similar. When you have a product team that says, oh, open source, it's free support, and I can take that off my balance sheet, and someone else can support those old drivers, and we can go work on the new interesting stuff. There has to be a governance model, at least, and someone has to be sitting there to say, the right way to participate in the community looks like this, and you need to have some skin in the game, too.
Yeah. I haven't heard free support in a long time, but I do remember those days. So Martin Taylor left recently. Is that helping you in your efforts to try to convince the company to be nice to Linux?
Is that helping me?
Well, he's portrayed as famously the guy who came up with some of those anti-Linux strategies.
Yeah, I think Martin's a good friend of mine. Martin did a very important thing that I think most of the outside world didn't see. He was quickly branded by the press as Mr. Anti-Linux. What he did is help centralize the company around getting everyone on the same page. Before, I would say 4 or 5 years ago, there were, you know, colorful comments like Linux is un-American and open source is a cancer, and people were just shooting and firing like the Wild West. And internally, it was crazy. Everyone had their own opinions, and people were trying different things out, and there was no cohesion. And Martin did a great job of getting people on the same page around that, at least in terms of how we message about it. So his, I would say, over the past few years, incrementally, in many ways, improved and learned a lot on how to be more strategic in how we think about open source. But what he did early on was very important.
Well, I would agree with you about bringing everybody together to the same page, but I think he's also the guy who funded all of the disinformation campaigns that were carried on for a while there. Are they stopping now? I mean, I saw the 12 principles stuff recently, and it looks to me like if you're actually going to live with those principles, because you're not going to retaliate against customers who go ahead and sell Linux as a product as well, your OEM customers, and other things like that, it looks like you would also be dropping some of the disinformation. Is that part of the plan?
Oh, we never had disinformation campaigns. We didn't. Let me be clear. What Get the Facts was, uh-huh, was not targeted to this audience. It wasn't.
But it was targeted to an audience that wants to use
it. Was
Linux
targeted at an audience, correct. So what I would say is, over time, what we've understood is that particular messaging format needs to be targeted more specifically with better information. And it is still part of what we do. It's still part of what we do. We've changed the way that we're doing it and executing it to be smarter. But we're also understanding there's a different type of audience that we need to communicate with differently. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I mean by sometimes blunt instruments. We had a loud voice around a subject that in many cases polarized people instead of gave them information of what they wanted to have. And that was in some ways damaging. In some ways it was beneficial to the people who were receptive of that.
Jason came up to me 2 years ago at this conference and asked me what the one thing he could do to make the open source community happy with Microsoft would be. And I said, you know, support open document format. It's really simple. That was 2 years ago. And now you guys are doing it, although you're not doing it yourselves. So I'm curious about that decision. How come you're not writing your own plugin?
That's a good question, and it's brought up all the time, of course, the open document format issue. So we have something called OpenXML, mm-hmm, which is our format, our XML-based format for Office 2007, our next version of Office. It is different in design and principle than ODF. When we heard feedback from particularly governments, particularly different states, heard feedback that, hey, this is important.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, what do both of these things try to do? They try to give the control puck back to the customer so they can control their data. That's the whole goal of this. Mm-hmm. So it's not locked away and they can archive and do what they want long term. So our intent and design of OpenXML is to do that. When we looked at the feedback on ODF, we said there's a few ways we can do this. There's a few ways we can support it. Again, different than OpenXML, because we actually have a tremendous amount of information in OpenXML for backwards compatibility that we can't sacrifice. We have to support that. So we said there's a few things we can do. We can build an ODF plugin native into Office, but being someone who deals with a very cynical audience often, you can imagine the scenario if you had Office and you saved out to ODF a Word document, Excel document, all of a sudden it was garbled and all messed up. And Microsoft said, aha, I told you this standard was ridiculous and ours is better. It would be a black box to people. So he said there's a smarter way to do this, which is make it transparent. We'll fund a project. We'll put it in open source. It's on SourceForge. It's under a BSD license. And that way people can see how it works and do what they want with it. And I personally think that was a smarter decision than trying to do it ourselves. Because I believe because of the level of heat around the subject, skepticism is the first rule of order when people get into this conversation. So the more transparent we could be with how this works, the better. And so that at the end of the day, that's what we have. We have the ability to do either ODF or the native OpenXML format, and customers have that control puck back.
So the goal then is to give customers the ability to not leave the Office world but still be able to use ODF. Is that the idea?
I don't know if I'd say it like that. I mean, the goal is that they can have. So what is OpenXML? It's open. It's XML based. In the format, there's an important element. There's probably some lawyers in a room called the covenant not to sue, where essentially what we did is removed the patent language around attribution and subclauses that says if there's violation of the patents in this format, we're making a promise not to sue. That's important. That's important to us to do that. And obviously, there's a lot of skepticism around when we do things like new formats around that very issue and the patents and IP around it.
Yeah, personally, I don't think an open standard should exist without one of those promises.
I believe so as well. It's very thematic, I would say, to gesture. It's very thematic of how we think about going forward.
But back to the question about whether customers can expect to be able to save out to ODF easily from Office. Because that's what governments seem to be wanting. They're basically saying, we're going to archive in ODF.
Correct.
And you're supposed to provide that capability. So is that possible?
Yes, that's what the plugin does.
Do you think it does it well?
I don't know.
Well, Grokla published yesterday a pretty lengthy pointer to a website by a guy named Rob Weir that does PDFs, side-by-side PDFs of what actually happens when you do those transforms right now, and it's pretty ugly. It works very well if you're trying to save ODF into Word, but not so well the other direction, and which is, you know, probably not surprising, but I think has to be fixed.
I don't know. I haven't tried it. I will say they are substantially different formats. I think ODF is, you know, a 400-page format. OpenXML is much larger because of backwards compat issues. Not to say one's better than the other, and I don't know how it turns out. The ability to do it, though, is important. And again, what we're trying to do is say, if there is, if we have an OpenXML format, the schema is open, ODF, the translator, the plugin, is open, people can participate, so that work can happen.
What do you think your hardest job is? What's the hardest thing you do? Is it internal-facing stuff or external-facing stuff?
I'd say dealing with closed-mindedness inside and outside. You know, when I speak at Linux World in Sao Paulo, Brazil.
Rough crowd.
And that's not the worst. Where people have very negative feelings about Microsoft as a brand.
Yeah.
And so talking about technology and what we want to do with our technology is not of interest. They hate the fact that Bill Gates makes money. They hate a lot of the capitalistic remnants of Microsoft as a successful company. I deal with it internally, too. I deal with people inside that have closed-mindedness about open source. The nice thing about Microsoft is full of good engineers, and it's run by good engineers who are technically interested in new things. So there is a common language to be able to talk about what these things mean. Why does open source have value? What are the pros and cons? Where does it work well? What can we learn? And so that helps, but closed-mindedness by far is the most, at least frustrating, if not difficult.
Rob Scoble, a lot of us know Rob because we're involved in social software, open source and social software sort of close, and he recently left. Is there going to be a, you know, cuddly Microsoft voice like Rob was, do you think?
I don't know if I'd call Scoble cuddly. What Scoble did is he broke a couple walls down inside Microsoft and said, yes, we can be not only transparent about what we do, but brutally honest and self-critical. And so now there's I think we have 3,000 people who blog every day, and most of those people are engineers and developers at Microsoft. Mm-hmm. I think that's been important. I think, though, I don't know if someone will replace Scoble because what he did is break down some walls. I think there'll be a lot of voices like him going forward. I hope there will be. And his work was very important because of that. Blogging has been, you know, once, as you know, working at a big company, once you get through enough critical mass, there's a unspoken cultural acceptance of things. And there's often not a mandate at companies like Microsoft or IBM or Intel or HP that says, blogging is okay. There may be guidelines and principles and HR policies and a bunch of stuff around that, but once the cultural mass gets high enough, it becomes accepted. At least it works at Microsoft that way. And I think Scoble did a great job getting that mass large enough. Mm-hmm. I think that will be continue a lot going forward. I mean, the reason why we did port 25 was because Scoble did Channel 9 and was able to walk around with a cheap video camera and interview interesting people working at the company. Mm-hmm. And we're doing the same thing as open source guys inside Microsoft. Who do we find interesting and what do we want to talk about and what do we do in our lab and things like that?
What are your guidelines for writing that content? Can you write anything?
I try to keep it. I think some of the guys who work for me are in the room. I try to keep it as organic as possible, and we don't have a heavy vetting process, at least for our stuff, a heavy vetting process of what we do. We do circulate it among, you know, five or six of us to say, do we think this is going to be interesting enough for people to want to hear about? But most of the time, we just write and go. And I know a lot of the other bloggers do something similar. We try to, from a company perspective, we try to make sure people don't take formal legal positions on a company. Like, we don't want everyone blogging about their, you know, our position in the EU if they don't understand the whole backstory behind it, because that stuff shows up in the press and it gets confusing. So the legal issues are usually one that people, I think, naturally stay away from, although I break into jail a lot on those just because I participate in a lot of that stuff. So talking about licensing, talking about IP is something that I think people are a little more nervous about than other subjects. But it's less processed than you might imagine.
Do you think the European Union did a better job of teaching Microsoft how to play fair than the United States? the 12 principles came out, and they basically read directly from the consent decrees, that, or the equivalent of decrees that are coming out of Europe. And I'm wondering, I mean, you know, in the U.S., when that was happening, the antitrust stuff was happening, it seems like the company just sort of held the line until we had a new president, you know. And the European Union seems to be doing a better job of sort of sticking to its guns. And it looks like Microsoft's learning, which is sort of encouraging.
I would actually say it differently. I think I was not at Microsoft when the DOJ hearing happened. However, I saw the after effect of it when I joined. And there was very much a change, at least internally, of how people behaved and acted related to the DOJ. I actually think we might have gone too conservative in some cases in certain areas. But there is a very clear and vivid awareness of issues related to antitrust and how we build software in the future. And the challenge here, as you know, is it's we don't reboot our software and rewrite it. actually, we don't do it that quickly often. But we don't. There's a lot of software we have that was written many years ago. And there's stuff that's brand new. And there's a mix of all of that together. So it's not like because we write a tremendous amount of software where we say, let's all just start over and try to use all these web services and all these new things and start over. There's, over 1 billion people using our software every day, 500 million legal users at least of Office. So there's a large wake on behind our boat that we have to think about. There's a lot of issues with the EU. We're appealing a lot of those issues. We have disagreements with some of the things in the EU. I do think that the 12 principles that you're seeing, a lot of the stuff you'll hear going forward around interoperability, has it been shaped by the DOJ and EU? Absolutely it has. It's also been shaped by us growing and getting smarter about how to write software in a very, very mixed environment.
Denise?
Yes.
Do you want to take questions?
Yeah,
from the
I'm sure. Are there people that want to have questions? Are you some of you guys? Oh, yeah, look, there's Steve Wally. Come on,
there's
Steve.
There's my buddy Steve.
So
you were one of the guys at Microsoft that was good.
Oh, yeah. So Bill, I haven't actually been paying attention for a while now since Wix and a few things like that went out the door.
Well, pay attention, Steve.
Thank you. So what are the other things that Microsoft is publishing into the open source community? Like I think Port 25 is great. I think it's awesome mm-hmm. to recreate the kind of buzz that went with Channel 9. But what software is coming out the door?
No,
You've
I
got
agree,
these huge assets.
Yeah.
Wix was actually pretty cool. What happened to that momentum? Are they going to do
yeah,
more?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, if you look back, May 2001, we released a lot of things with shared source. Component-level things for developers, ASP.NET starter kits, things like that, things that get people ramped up. And we've continued to do developer-related things, USB drivers, things of that nature. We are moving forward with more product-oriented things going forward, how we think about assets that we have, because people get a little bit myopic on, the big 2.5 or 3, Windows Office and the server business. We actually have a massive amount of, as you know, Steve, a massive amount of software that is assets to Microsoft. We have lots of video games. We have lots of drivers. We have lots of things we built over time. So we're taking a broader look at those types of things and saying, can those work as well? Wix, as people may or may not know, is the installer for Windows and was a project we did that was really successful in releasing on SourceForge under the IBM CPL license. And it's still a successful project. We're still getting a lot from it. We use that as sort of a testament, particularly in executive meetings at Microsoft, of how this can work. We've gotten over 500 bugs fixed. We get about 2 or 3 new bugs fixed a week in our installer. MySQL uses Wix to install on Windows. And it's been a good learning lesson for us. So going forward, to answer your question more directly, it will be things that enable, again, we are very focused on how do we make developers do better, whatever license they want to license on with their software, how do we help them, which is why we have a new thing called CodePlex, which is a community area for building apps. But we'll do a lot. We just released a set of Ajax tools that are under shared source licenses, and we'll be doing more, I would say, product-oriented things with assets going forward, too. So the answer is yes. Are we incrementing to greater things? I could list, the collection of things that are under shared source. I think what's more important is that we're looking at what are the assets that we can take advantage of and how do they fit with the community. There's some things that we've looked at, to be quite honest, that don't work in a community model. They just don't. They require, as Chris was talking about, we have an entirely separate build system for a lot of our software. So it's not like you take a chunk of some products and say, oh, but without the tool chain, You know, you're kind of on your own. So we have to look at all those issues as we think about sharing source.
That actually reminded me of the licensing question. I know licenses, to Tim's point earlier, is not the be-all and end-all of open source, but you guys wrote a bunch of licenses about EuroOSCON last year, and there are various folks in license discuss at OSI that really want to discuss those licenses, and OSI's policy is, you know, we have to wait for the author to decide they want us to have that discussion. So when are you going to submit them?
It's a good question. So about a year ago, we rewrote all of our shared source licenses to be much simpler. Good, bad, or indifferent, one thing we have at Microsoft is some reasonable licensing attorneys. Reasonable, you might debate, but they're talented.
Have you read the EULA?
So we got those guys in a room and said, listen, write a license for me, a developer, that I can understand without bringing in a bunch of lawyers and, you know, take out things that are all caps and all the legalese.
Yeah, they're definitely shorter. It's really good.
And so we have three now, and one called the Microsoft Community License has been pretty popular. Sugar CRM is licensing under that for their next version of Sugar CRM for Windows. So we have tried to clean that up to a large extent. Now, how that relates to the OSI is a little more complicated because we do think that it might be a great thing to participate in the OSI. And I've talked with a few people in the room here about that participation. It's something that I am very open to having a conversation about, but I have a lot of other things I think that the OSI and Microsoft need to talk about as well as we go through that process. It's not just simple enough as submitting the license. So I'm open and eager to do it, but there's other conversations we have to have around their position around Microsoft and how we can work together in a more benign and at least equal way together before we participate that way.
Next question from the audience.
Hi, yeah, Kartik Subbarao, HP.
Hi, Kartik.
Hi. One of the questions that I think is fundamental to those of us in the audience and the open source community at large for that matter, and this came up yesterday during one of the tutorials, is can we trust Microsoft? You know, given the history of embrace, extend, extinguish, given the history of protocols that are mostly open but somewhat selective and can enable lock-in, what is Microsoft doing to directly address that issue head-on? And given what you know, Tim mentioned earlier today, given that web services are now not just about releasing the code, but presenting an ongoing presence that at any point in time, if the company decides to behave differently, can go away, what is Microsoft doing to directly address that issue?
It's a good question.
It's a really good question.
It's a big mountain in every conversation I have, particularly with an open source audience. The simplest way I can answer that is consistent action over time in the right direction. I believe less in talking about what we're going to do and more about actually delivering over time consistently a certain behavior. That's the only way I believe people will trust us in this environment. There's lots of other stuff we're doing around brand and customer but related to this environment, it's consistent action over time in the right direction.
Do you feel that people like Ray Ozzie and Steve Ballmer support what you're doing fully in this regard?
I do.
Okay.
That's interesting. Even though you know they keep coming up with the comments, the random comments that are hard to deal with.
But they're less and less.
You know, I don't know. You're always a bad guy, no matter what you do, though, because
yeah, here
you are keeping people from coffee break. Thank you very much.
Thanks to Bill Hilf, Denise Cooper, Tim O'Reilly, and Brian Bellendorf. If you have ideas to share with us, send an email to future@oreilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme. Visit David at Batmosphere.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Bias Peak, and Audio Hijack Pro.